Good afternoon and welcome to our symposium on HIV and human security. I'm the moderator of this symposium. My name is Alex Duval. I'm a program director at the Social Science Research Council in New York, and we have an excellent panel to speak to us this afternoon. A word of introduction. At the turn of the millennium, in January 2000, the UN Security Council debated HIV/AIDS as a threat to international peace and security, the first time that the UN Security Council had considered a disease as such a threat. One motivation for this was the fear that HIV/AIDS as a disease, as a pandemic, would pose a threat to the hard security interests of the major states in the world, that it would make armies unable to function, peacekeeping missions would fail, humanitarian crises would be exacerbated and would be unmanageable, states would collapse. And a national security assessment by the National Intelligence Council of the United States made some very, very dire predictions as to what would happen. A second motivation that contributed to that debate and the subsequent UN Security Council resolutions was a very different tradition of approaching security concerns as human security concerns, believing that ultimately the concern of the people of the planet should not be primarily the security of states, the strength of military forces, but that security rested ultimately on the well-being of human beings, on their lives, their livelihoods, and their human rights. And I think it is this particular philosophy of human rights and human security that will be represented more in this panel today. We did invite a couple of other panelists who were not able to come, and the advantage of that is that we have really time for a thorough discussion of the issues that will be raised by the three that we have, and I will introduce them one by one. And first of all, we have Mary Robinson, whom I'm sure needs really no introduction to any of you, the first woman to become President of the Republic of Ireland, serving for 7 years, subsequently the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She has a background as an activist, a barrister, a campaigner, a member of the Irish Senate. And she's currently honorary president of Oxfam International and president of Realising Rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think from here, yeah? I think from here. I must say, when I received the invitation to participate in this panel, I had to think a little bit about what are the connections that we would really want to bring out. I'm aware that there is a certain amount of debate and a certain amount of research that is coming to the fore about the connections between conflicts, disasters and HIV. That's not going to be my expertise. I'll leave that to the other panelists, and there's probably quite a bit of expertise in this room. Mine is actually more personal in a way. I want to speak about this with some passion. Last September, I went with five African women leaders and two others from outside Africa, eight of us, to Eastern Chad to be on the border so that we could talk to women and their families that had come across from Darfur and also talk to internally displaced families in Chad itself, the country of which they were citizens. And we talked, we listened, we saw the pain in the voices and the gestures of women when they talked about the terrible circumstances that had driven them from their village. I still remember some of those stories, and they bring tears even now. And then we asked those women, you know, we're here to listen to you. What is the most important thing for you? What do you want the world to know? You know, just give us maybe the three things that are most important. And they were security, security, security. Neither in the refugee camp, sadly, nor in the IDP camp were these women safe. And of course they weren't safe if they went outside. And we tried to ask them, who was it? And it was anybody in uniform or half uniform. They could be government side, they could be rebel side, it didn't matter. They were fair game. They were raped, they were attacked, they were assaulted, and this was their reality. This morning, I went along, as I had done last year, because I'm on the jury of the 25 communities that are part of the Red Ribbon Awards presentation, which will take place this evening. And I like going because these are community-based approaches, which I'm very strongly in favour of. And one of the questioners, after a couple of us spoke briefly, was somebody who is involved in social action for women in Thailand. And she described that her organisation works with more than 150,000 Burmese who fled their own country and resettled in northwestern Thailand, where they have basically no access to government medical or social services. They've had no education about HIV, and so her organisation has responded by opening a healthcare house for women living with HIV and AIDS. And she asked me, how much do you think the conflict is contributing in terrible violations of human rights? Very much the kind of question that we're going to be asking on this panel. And it was clear that she felt very strongly that the lack of protection of human rights, and particularly of women's rights, and the lack of access to knowledge and education were all incredibly relevant and significant. And I think we have to gather in more and more of this community-based experience in order to make a real assessment of the situation. Naturally, I do look at this very much from a strong human rights perspective. And in that context, the concept of human security holds that ensuring what we call freedom from want, more the economic and social rights, and freedom from fear, freedom from torture, freedom from killing, rape, etc. Freedom from want and freedom from fear for all is the best means for tackling issues of global insecurity. It encompasses respect for human dignity, for physical safety, for economic and social well-being, all of which, of course, are at the heart of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And as you know, this year, and on the 10th of December, we mark the 60th anniversary. You know, I keep going back to the Universal Declaration, and I refer to it every day because it's part of my work. And I'm struck we would not get as good a document again if the political leaders were to gather around and devise a Universal Declaration. It would be a much less bold document than that existing document. So let's remember and reclaim it very actively during the 60th anniversary year for that reason. Gender inequalities clearly challenge human security, and they aggravate the impact of HIV because they prevent access to clinics, they have all kinds of negative impacts. Women and girls, as we know, are biologically, socially and economically more susceptible to HIV, particularly in conflict and other emergency settings. Gender discrimination, violence, insufficient access to health information and services, economic insecurity and lack of equal protection under the law, land and property insecurity, and an inability to negotiate safer sex all increase vulnerability to HIV for women and girls. I've just come from a press conference that Oxfam organised on the basis of their report about the shame and disgrace over the last 15 years of not having greater access to female condoms. It's in situations of conflict and insecurity that they would be even more needed so that women can protect themselves. And this is another dimension of our failures to look at this whole issue from the perspective of those most affected, most trying to combat the barriers and the difficulties, and least listened to, which is one of the problems. As we know, and has been repeated in this conference, adult women in sub-Saharan Africa are more likely to be infected with HIV than their male counterparts. I understand that about 75% of the young who are infected in sub-Saharan Africa are women. 75%. And that's a huge and very damning statistic. The power imbalances that increase vulnerability of women and girls to HIV may be more pronounced, and I believe are more pronounced, in situations of disaster, conflict and post-conflict for a variety of reasons, including increased risk of sexual exploitation and violence, breakdown of family and other social structures, and limited access to healthcare. And I think that many of us are really still grappling with the harsh realities of the scale of the problem of gender-based and sexual violence, which has become such a routine weapon of war. And yet, we very rarely see the perpetrators brought to account. We very rarely see any major attempt to prevent and bring perpetrators to account. Let's just look at some of the statistics that I think we're, as I said, trying to even imagine, and yet we know that they're the tip of the iceberg. They're the ones that we know. According to the United Nations, in Sierra Leone, between 50,000 and 64,000 internally displaced women suffered sexual assault by combatants. 20,000 to 50,000 women were raped during the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina in the early 1990s. In 2006, more than 27,000 cases of rape and sexual violence were registered in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I think that's one of the worst places. The sheer deliberate attempt to destroy the body of a woman in the most savage way possible, and not just women, but girls and even young girls, in the province of South Kivu alone. And this horrific violence not only destroys the lives of the women and girls affected, their families, and also the whole social fabric of their communities, it also, of course, greatly increases their risk of HIV infection. And I'm glad that at least the Security Council in June recognized wartime rape as a security issue that warrants a security response. And I would add the global food crisis is worsening the impact of HIV, particularly in these settings, with women bearing the heaviest burden. Food insecurity has in many cases has many causes, most of them long-term and structural, and in many places food security and armed conflict overlap, and armed conflict will deny food security. I remember going in 1992 to Somalia, where the food could not get to those who were dying, waiting in the queues at the feeding stations because of the conflict. Globally, as we know, 850 million people suffer from hunger, and the vast majority are in the developing world. And there is the acute problem of the steady rise in stable food prices. Conflict and post-conflict countries tend to be especially food insecure, with greater than 20% of the population, and often far more, lacking access to adequate food. Despite the bulk of the work to grow and feed their families, despite doing the bulk of the work, women go hungry the most, accounting for 60% of the world's hungry people. So food insecurity and poor nutrition, as we know, hasten the progression of AIDS-related illnesses and undermine HIV prevention efforts. So what is the way forward? What are we going to try to address when we link human security and HIV and try to move forward? First of all, and this has been repeated in so many other contexts during this AIDS conference, gender equality and women's empowerment are vital to preventing the spread of HIV and mitigating its impact, particularly in conflict and disaster settings. Laws and policies that protect women and girls from gender discrimination and violence, promote gender equality and women's economic empowerment, and address the specific health needs of women, including their rights to sexual and reproductive health, can help reduce vulnerabilities to HIV and contribute to greater security and well-being for women. That's a statement we can make about stable societies where it's poverty perhaps and remoteness from centres where it's possible to get access to information and to preventive measures and to care, etc. But in situations of conflict, all of this, as we know, is aggravated. Member states must be accountable for the full implementation of Security Council Resolution 1820, which outlines concrete actions against sexual violence, including training and military disciplinary measures. And I mentioned earlier the need to bring perpetrators to justice, whether they wear the uniform of the United Nations peacekeeping or national uniforms, or if they are rebel forces, there's still the duty to protect. This resolution reaffirms the status of sexual violence as a war crime, crime against humanity, and constituent act of genocide, depending on the elements of the offence, and reaffirms the importance of women's participation in all processes related to ending sexual violence, including through structured access to peace talks. In Realizing Rights, the organization I'm involved in, we have a Women Leaders Intercultural Forum, which with a number of partners is encouraging plans of action under 1325, that women are there at the peace table, that they are decision makers, that their capacity to be agents for change is recognized much more. And I must just mention, because I think it really is a good practice, the intense concentration for more than 3 years now, we're in our fourth year, that is taking place in Ireland between all of the aid agencies, including the Irish Red Cross, and Irish Aid at the table, representing the Irish government, and the Defence Forces. Intensive discussion of how Ireland as a donor country, Ireland as a country in developing countries, and Ireland in Ireland can do more to address gender-based violence. I think if in every developed country you had that prioritising of tackling gender-based violence and then bringing this to the work that was being done in situations of conflict and post-conflict, we would do a lot more. The inspiration for this intensive discussion, and I'm the sort of honorary mentor or something of it, and I meet the group once a year, and I'll be meeting them again in November, and we discuss the progress being made. The inspiration came from a sense of dismay and helplessness about what was happening in Darfur. And I heard from a number of my Irish colleagues of Concern and Trocra and others who'd been on the ground in Darfur. The trouble is, they said, we never started with a policy of gender-based violence. We had no safe places. We had no opportunities for women to complain. We just let it drift into a level of violence which should never have been tolerated. And now we have on top of that the food crisis. So I think it is appropriate that this session is linking gender and security and HIV. And I will always want us to go on an evidence-based route, but I personally have to say that it's almost the old Latin term, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. When you have all those conditions that I have seen and that I will probably see again in October when we're hoping to go to Darfur and meet with a women's forum there that Bintou Diop is bringing together, over 400 women, I have no doubt those women will be able to say very expressly how much worse it is in the context of HIV when you have no security and when you have no protection and when you have no access to the healthcare and the information that you need. So this is a very serious issue, and I look forward to the contributions of others, but I'm really very glad that this session is taking place. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Mary. And as moderator, I want to actually, before we move on to WASAI, I want to pose a question to you, which actually brings in my other professional hat, which is I worked in Darfur in the 1980s, particularly with the Darfur Arabs. Yes. And on revisiting them and talking to many of them, including many of the men who have actually perpetrated these atrocities, they see themselves as victims too. And clearly they have committed dreadful wrongs, but their sense is that they are victims of a system, and they are people who have been stripped of their dignity, they have been shamed. And the question I want to pose to you is you talk about bringing individuals to justice, and we all, I think, support that. Bringing systems to justice, systems that deprive men of a positive masculinity, a masculinity that can be more respectful of women.
It's a very interesting question, and I do know of the expertise you have and the length of time you spent in Sudan and specifically in Darfur, and you can speak with authority about that sense of humiliation. We also have to bear in mind the fact that this was probably one of those early examples of the impacts of climate change, the drying up, struggle for land, pastoral land, and so on. And I think the systems, addressing the systems issue, can be done now by inquiries, by reconciliation commissions. You know, I'm very much in favour of the various forms of looking at justice from the perspective of a much broader range of victims than will ever get into a court of law. I think that complements being able to address the main perpetrators. And I see no reason why we can't develop a more sophisticated way of actually addressing precisely. Because if we do that, we learn a great deal more about how to prevent, which is what we all should be doing. And so I would certainly see no objection from a human rights point of view, and in fact a lot of validity, in trying to have a systems justice approach investigation of the roots of not just Darfur, but a lot of other similar causes, because otherwise we're not going to learn how to prevent and how to address more quickly and prevent the kind of anger and humiliation that can manifest itself in terrible violence against women.
Thank you. Let me now ask Wasai Jacob Nanjakululu to make his presentation. Wasai is currently head of Oxfam's Global AIDS Program. Formerly, he was AIDS Policy and Advocacy Officer at Accord, in charge of HIV/AIDS. He's a social scientist. He has a Bachelor of Arts degree in Government and Public Administration and a postgraduate certificate in Gender Mainstreaming and Development, and extensive experience in this area. Wasai, do you want to speak from the podium, where you can handle your presentation more easily? So if you can speak for about 15 minutes.
Thank you very much. First, I would like to thank the organizers of this conference for giving me this opportunity to stand before you and talk to you about a topic that is very close to my heart. I'm also humbled by the very fact that I am part of a very distinguished panel, and I just want to acknowledge that. I also wish to really acknowledge the fact that the chair of this session is one resource that I've used in compiling the paper that I'm going to be using to speak to you about this topic. And I have prepared the paper, so those of you who like to delve into it in detail can get it from the desk at the entrance. First, before I go into this presentation, I just want to frame it. Over 10 years ago, when I left college, I was involved in awareness-raising sessions on HIV and AIDS, conducting workshops under the workplace policies in Kenya. And one of those sessions, we used to encourage participants to give their personal stories. In one such a session, a lady stood up and gave her story. This story might just explain some of the challenges that we face in dealing with HIV/AIDS in Africa. She said her husband and herself earned less than $200 a month. They had two children, two daughters, one aged 7, another one aged 4. And I want to speak to you, hope, in the expectation that we have all broken the silence around HIV and AIDS. And she said that because of their means, they lived in a room that was 10 by 8 feet and therefore had a double deck bed. So they would sleep in the lower deck with the husband, and the children, the two children, would be on the upper deck. But some things had to happen, like because the husband and wife. So they would wait for the children to snore and then may begin making love. But in one such instant, they thought the children had slept. They started. And the younger kid, who was 4 years then, tapped the older kid and said, "Hold the bed tight."
kite they have started. And my presentation is about conflict in Africa. And I'm asking, is AIDS an artificial epidemic thriving in conflict situations? I'm looking at conflict from a broader perspective. At various points of this epidemic, 27 years now, Africa has taken the largest share of the AIDS burden, between 65 to 70% global AIDS burden. Africa, too, is a continent that is characterized by conflict, underdevelopment, poor governance, dilapidated social and health service infrastructure. AIDS is still a killer disease in Africa. And I'm asking, is it therefore an artificial epidemic? What is an artificial epidemic? Artificial epidemics are attributes of society, products of a false culture, or a culture that is not available to all classes. These are indicators of defects produced by political and social organization, and therefore affect predominantly those classes that do not participate in the advantages of the culture. At various points in the sessions that you might have been to, some of the buzzwords could have been marginalized, voiceless, men who have sex with men, women, the poor. This definition speaks to some of these issues. Social inequalities and disruptions are central to the spread of HIV in Africa. Gender injustice, sexual and gender-based violence, poverty, inadequate opportunities for self-advancement. Therefore, making the struggle against HIV and AIDS a struggle also against sexual and gender-based violence, conflict, a fight for women's rights, children, sex workers, and generally, social justice and peace. The dual burden of AIDS and conflict in Africa. We all understand that conflict disrupts development, goes against the rule of law. Sometimes it even ends in states to collapse. Particularly, AIDS itself changes demography, family structure, weakens economies, and undermines governance. In a recent study, for instance, it was established that South Africa is losing 28,000 voters between the ages of 30 to 39 every month, interfering totally with the electoral roll. In the same study, it was established that certain countries in Africa are losing many members of parliament in the AIDS era compared to the era before HIV and AIDS. And the cost of replacing a member of parliament, for instance, in Zambia is $200,000. In Tanzania is $400,000. These are poor countries. They can't afford that. Then during war, fathers bury their sons. Similarly, with AIDS, fathers bury their sons. This is a map I used in a session where I was talking about a double disaster, climate change and HIV and AIDS wreaking havoc in Southern Africa. But we can still use it here. It's because we have multiple of vulnerabilities in Africa. And most of the countries, even with those colors, are in conflict. And just to give the Uganda example, Those of you who have watched the last King of Scotland might be aware of the history of Uganda. Uganda happens to have had among the first cases of HIV and AIDS. Around 1979, the army of Tanzania, under Mwalimu Julius Nyerere then, attacked Uganda to root the dictator out of Uganda. They entered through the border between Tanzania and Uganda. One of the first districts to be devastated by HIV and AIDS was Rakai district near Lake Victoria, where we had military activity. So the linkages, although anecdotal, seem to show that the pattern of HIV and AIDS followed that military activity in Uganda around that time. The case of Burundi. We know that by 2002, Burundi had about 600,000 orphans. Many as a result of war, but also 230,000 of them estimated to have lost parents due to AIDS. Most of these children also witnessed violent attacks and rapes. And also the breakdown of social order led to many girls and women to be raped. Sometimes when the guns fall silent, the male organ takes over. Systematic mass rapes during war, for instance in Uganda, Mozambique, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Rwanda, Somalia, and DRC, have been known to be used as a weapon of war. It is known, for instance, that spread of terror and fear through inflicting mass rapes is also used as a weapon of war. Because they think by doing this, you disable the enemy by destroying the bonds of family. We also note that non-consensual sex increases trauma and susceptibility to HIV infection. For instance, after the genocide in 1994 in Rwanda, about 24% of women, pregnant women, tested HIV positive. But we also have exceptional conflicts. Sierra Leone, after the war, HIV prevalence was estimated at between 1 to 4%, much lower than it was thought during the war. Angola, too. By the end of the war in 2002, HIV prevalence in Rwanda was between 5 to 10%. Rural areas, it was about 1 to 3%, much lower than neighbors who had not experienced war. Reasons given for this sometimes is because perhaps there isn't infrastructure, for instance, health services, to be able to know the prevalence in such a situations. But mostly also because sometimes within those populations, the movement could be restricted in certain places so that there isn't as much movement as you would have expected of people in such a situations or in situations of no war. Drivers of AIDS in conflict. Even though we have exceptional cases, it's also thought that in conflict, movement from especially low prevalence to high prevalence areas, or otherwise from high prevalence to low prevalence areas, could have an effect on HIV AIDS spread. And also inaccessibility to AIDS services like condoms, drugs, and other health services. An example is given there for Western Uganda. There is also the absence of parenting guidance, which exposes adolescents to risk behaviors. The danger, too, of sexual barter, sexual barter trading due to food insecurity, poverty and powerlessness. And also insecurity that coerces women and girls to exchange sex for protection. For instance, we have that example from Sudan, where 25% of single mothers became sex workers to earn a living. We have those challenges too, which I will not go into so much. But before I conclude, I just want to say something here. That HIV and AIDS, especially in Africa, occurs within a social, economic and political context. And therefore, interventions on HIV and AIDS in Africa must take this into consideration. The lady I told you about in the beginning of this presentation, after the end of that workshop, pulled me aside and told me that if you will ever, because you are a young person going out there, please, you might not see the need to talk to us about HIV/AIDS in the future if only we had the economic muscle. If, for instance, I had a good salary, I was on medical insurance, a pension, perhaps I would be able to manage most of these things and avoid the risks that we face daily because of our socio-economic status. That AIDS intervention should also recognize malfunctional socio-economic and political systems which entrench injustice and marginalize the poor, youth, children and women. That we need to also address AIDS even during conflict and not just after conflict. That humanitarian ceasefires should incorporate prevention education, condoms and VCT. Then humanitarian assistance should include HIV prevention care and treatment in addition to food and general medical supplies. And HIV prevention be a first-line response to sexual violence through STI treatment and post-exposure prophylaxis. Should also consider resource and program sexual violence as part of human rights advocacy, reproductive health rights as a gender issue should also be considered. That we also have theoretical, legal, and policy agreement, which is needed on what constitutes sexual violence across different social cultural settings, because some will not accept that, in fact, that they were in the wrong for committing such crimes against humanity. More research, too, is needed to explain patterns, scale and scope of sexual violence during and after conflicts. We should also link research information to surveillance, monitoring and reporting systems for HIV and AIDS to determine links and trends between sexual and gender-based violence, forced sex, and HIV vulnerability. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to thank you for having been patient to listen to me in presenting this presentation to you, and I look forward to engaging with you on questions after this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Wasai. I have many questions, but rather than pose any of them now, I will turn to our third and final panelist, Paul Spiegel. Paul is the Chief of Public Health and the HIV section at the UN High Commission for Refugees. Prior to that, he worked for the Centers for Disease Control. Prior to that, he worked for a number of NGOs. He has extensive experience of public health and humanitarian emergencies. He's also the author of a number of forthright and provocative articles, and I'm sure he will have many things to say. Paul, over to you.
Well, Okay, great. Thank you very much. Thank you to the organizers, Dennis Altman and Krista Neuhaus, for organizing this, and in particular to Alex as well for chairing the session. I'm going to argue today really that the exceptionalism in conflicts that my colleague from Oxfam said is in fact the norm, and that Sierra Leone, Angola, and many other conflicts actually keep HIV prevalence relatively lower than would be the case if there was no conflict. This is a simple map by Nancy Mock and Al that was published a couple of years ago, showing here the major war conflicts with greater than 100,000 casualties, and here showing the HIV prevalence at the end of 2001. And as you can see, it is inversely proportional, and those that have a lot of conflicts actually have a lower HIV prevalence. Again, this is just associative and by no means causative. Here is an example in northern Uganda. A couple years ago, World Vision put out a study saying that northern Uganda, the crisis was fueling the HIV epidemic, and they used simple point prevalence, pointing out that in northern Uganda, it was double, the HIV prevalence was double the overall HIV prevalence in Uganda. But that's a fundamental mistake. As an epidemiologist, you of course have to look at trends. And so here, if you look at, for instance, Gulu, this is in northern Uganda with the antenatal sentinel surveillance, you will see over time during the war, the HIV prevalence in northern Uganda decreased, very similar to other, here's Kampala, and a very similar trend to other bigger cities, as is Gulu in northern Uganda. Here are two other lines looking in Moyo and Kitgum, if I'm not mistaken, in much more rural areas using prevention of mother-to-child transmission data. And this shows much larger, much lower HIV prevalence than obviously up in Gulu. And again, this points consistently, except in DRC, to a large difference in conflict and other settings between urban and rural, which we much differentiate. But the point here is that overall, during the war in northern Uganda that has been going on, the HIV prevalence fell in a very similar pattern to the other larger urban areas in Uganda. Here's an example of the Democratic DRC. This was antenatal sentinel surveillance done in 2003 and 2004. Similar prevalence data have been released 6 to 8 months ago for 2005. And if you look, the overall HIV prevalence is 4.9%, and this is the 95% confidence interval. In Western DRC, that has not been has not been involved in conflict for the most part, 4.1% with the confidence interval. And Eastern DRC, slightly higher at 4.9%, but again, the confidence intervals overlap, and there is actually, it's not statistically significant. So despite the claims, which makes sense, that Eastern DRC, because of all the conflict, the massive sexual violence that we know is going on, there actually in 2003 and 4 and in 2005 is no different. There are no difference. Is no difference in the overall HIV prevalence between the two parts of the country. And here, using the 2003 and 4 data, we can look at in the both rural and in urban areas the HIV prevalence data. For example, in Bukavu, an urban area, it was 3.1% with the 95% confidence interval. And here we look at Burundi, Uganda, Rwanda, and some other nearby sites, Central African Republic. And for the most part, the HIV prevalence is significantly higher than in Eastern DRC. Let us look at some other conflict-affected areas. Angola. 3.9% in 2003, this means the antenatal care, so pregnant women sentinel surveillance data, significantly lower than surrounding countries in southern Africa. Liberia, 1.5% in 2007, again, significantly lower than was hypothesized and lower than many countries in West Africa, and this is population-based data from demographic health surveys. Mozambique, 2.9% in 1992-93, and significant increase post-war, 4.5% in 97. Sierra Leone, and we can go through all of these. But for the most part, you will see these countries that have had long-term conflicts have relatively, everything is relative, of course, but relatively low HIV prevalence compared to surrounding communities, some of which I have shown you, and some of which the surrounding communities' country data I have not listed here. You can have a quick read here for Mozambique. Mozambique is probably the best case example, and many countries seem to follow this, where in Mozambique, during the long war, HIV prevalence was kept relatively low. Post-war, as we know, Mozambique's HIV prevalence has increased significantly. Everything I'm showing you here, the data and or statements, are all from peer-reviewed journals. Angola, again, the level of armed conflict was found to be inversely related to the HIV prevalence. And then it goes on to say why there is a big fear in Angola, I believe justly, that HIV prevalence will increase in the post-conflict. And finally, there's a multi-country study that we did in Africa, in Lancet, looking at Burundi, Sierra Leone, Rwanda, DRC, Liberia, Sudan, and Uganda. And the data from these countries did not show an increase in prevalence of HIV infection during periods of conflict. Interestingly, I had hypothesized early on that those countries where conflict started and the HIV prevalence was low, it would be kept low. But those were countries, like in northern Uganda, where the HIV prevalence was high, I had anticipated that it actually would become worse during conflict. But that does not appear to be the case in the data that I won't present here. I did present for northern Uganda, but also for Rwanda and in Burundi. It actually fell. And I just want to round off the story looking briefly at some of the refugee issues. Again, not surprising. When I came to UNHCR from CDC, the first thing I wanted to do was measure. That's what we like to do at CDC, is measure things. And I was told we can't do that because the HIV prevalence amongst refugees will be significantly higher and it will increase the stigma and discrimination towards that already are very high towards refugees. But we did it anyways because from a public health point of view, one has to be able to measure and then try to implement and then look at measure again and see what effect you've had. Over time, we did some other studies, and I will get to those sentinel surveillance studies. But overall, this just shows the country of origin and the country of asylum where refugees have moved. And this is the N equals 29. This was in 2004. 29 countries with greater than or equal to 10,000 refugees, where they came from, where they moved. Again, buttressing the argument that refugees are coming from conflict, often lower prevalence, moving to higher prevalence. The same is in Asia, and much of what I'm saying does apply to Asia, although I'm not mentioning it here. This I don't expect you to read up here, but basically what this is antenatal sentinel surveillance in our camp, in the camps, Burundian refugees in Tanzania, DRC refugees in Tanzania, DRC refugees in Rwanda, etc. We have Zambia, Eritrean refugees in Sudan, in Uganda, Sudanese refugees in Kenya. And what we have are the HIV prevalence rates and the dates. And then we have tried to the best that we can look at the host population. It's extremely difficult because often the HIV prevalence rates do not exist for the host population. So we did our best to at least look at the district level of HIV prevalence. And for the most part, 9 had lower prevalence, the refugees did, and 2 had a similar prevalence, and 1 actually had a higher prevalence than their respective host communities. You have to, of course, recognize that many of these refugees have lived in these refugee camp situations, and these are all camp, for well over 10 years, and therefore there's been an acclimatization. So, how am I doing for time? Well, I want to look at the vulnerability and risk factors in conflict-affected populations. Basically, what our colleague from Oxfam, and I think what most people look at, is the increased vulnerability and risk due to many of these situations, the factors that our colleagues mentioned: behavioral change, huge amount of gender violence, transactional sex, reduction in resources and services. But what people, I believe, have not really concentrated sufficiently on, when you have mobility, what is the HIV prevalence of the group? It does not have to be refugees, of course. It can be migrant workers. It can be internally displaced persons. What is the HIV prevalence in the area of origin where they have come from? What is the surrounding population if they have moved? What is the HIV prevalence there? What is the level of interaction between them? what is the environment? I believe, but we don't have sufficient data for urban refugees, unfortunately, but I believe camp refugees will remain significantly lower, where urban refugees, often mirroring, I believe, economic migrants, may have these vulnerability and risk factors may outweigh some of the reduction in vulnerability and risk. I'll skip those. And then here, probably the most important aspects that for the most part appear to outweigh the increases is a huge reduction in mobility and accessibility of these populations. Many of us have spent time in these countries and the roads are broken down. People are not moving into the urban areas. The urban areas are not able to urbanize as would be if there was no conflict. And so the huge amount of reduction of mobility, the reduction in mobility, accessibility, and lack of urbanization, I believe for the most part, outweighs many of the vulnerability, increase in vulnerability and risks, and therefore, in many situations, conflict may actually have a protective factor. Some of the limitations, and of course there are many, these are cross-sectional retrospective data. We're not looking at prospective data. It would be wonderful if we could, but we have not. There's some of this in Guinea-Bissau. So, of course, what we're talking about here is associative. It's not causative. We can clearly not say, because of conflict, the HIV prevalence is not as high in these countries that have suffered conflict compared to those that have not been in conflict. Similarly, there may be many confounders that we have not examined. In these models, we didn't look at circumcision. There are known limitations of antenatal care and population-based surveys measuring HIV prevalence, generally ANC data being higher and population-based prevalence being lower. There's a lack of trend data in many conflict and post-conflict countries. And because of the lack of reliability of data during conflict, for the most part, we're relying on post-conflict data to get our, we're using those as proxies as what may have happened during the conflict or at least during the latter part of the conflict. So in conclusion, and this is very important because much of the, as Alex mentioned, some of the data we have been presenting has been caused concern to many colleagues, in particular advocates. And when I presented some of the early refugee prevalence data showing that it was lower than we thought, the head of the Africa Bureau at UNHCR at that time said, "That's wonderful, we can put our resources elsewhere." Wrong. We have to be very careful how we present this data. It doesn't mean that conflict, we shouldn't be doing anything in conflict. All of the recommendations that our Oxfam colleagues said should be done at the beginning of conflict and even before conflict begins. But it does mean that conflict may not exacerbate the problem as we had originally predicted. And in fact, I believe very strongly that it's the post-conflict situations where we'll have more bang for our buck. It doesn't mean we need to ignore conflict, of course not, but I think post-conflict areas, and right now in Angola, Sierra Leone, Liberia, are major, major areas where we need to be concentrating on. So, advocacy is important, but we must reflect the latest data, and I think as many of you know right now, our credibility in the AIDS world in some ways with data is at stake. From books from Elizabeth Persani, of course, Jim Chen, and some of their points are valid. We have people amongst the AIDS community that advocate and are not always using the data properly to advocate, and it could be seen as manipulation. And we have to be very careful to avoid this. HIV and AIDS is still very important in conflict settings, but as I mentioned, I think post-conflict settings, it is extremely important. We need to look at interactions here between refugees and host populations and any other population that has moved. We can't do, and we are trying to do this with the Great Lakes Initiative on AIDS and others, we can't program parallel programs for refugees, parallel programs for host populations. They obviously have to be interlinked because of the huge amount of connection and social networks amongst these populations. And some of the further research areas that I would like all of us to look into are refugees and non-camp situations. Internally displaced persons, I believe there are some good data for northern Uganda IDPs, but for the most part, IDPs, there are very little data. The effects of refugees returning home on HIV transmission, and we have done a bunch of behavioral surveillance surveys looking at refugees in Sudanese refugees in Kenya and Uganda, as well as Sudanese people that have not actually left in southern Sudan that did not leave. And we're finding very interesting issues regarding knowledge behavior. And so it would be very interesting to see, because a lot of, I'm concerned, of course, from a stigma point of view, that refugees will be blamed coming home of being Trojan horses in their own countries. We have to be very careful there, and we also have to look at the data properly. And then finally, as I mentioned, behavioral surveillance surveys amongst these populations are very important, because we can't, HIV prevalence is too far down the road. What we need to look at is what are the knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors of these populations, and how can we use our programs to ensure that we target and make them as effective as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. And your presentation is, as always, challenging, and I'm sure there are a lot of questions that that arise from it. What we're going to do with questions is, first of all, I'd like to recognize Alan Whiteside, who is somewhere, Alan, and who wants to make a couple of points, I believe. So, Alan, come to the microphone.
Thank you very much. My name is Alan Whiteside. I'm from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban in South Africa. This session, which is a really important one, is talking about conflict. We've just done some work in Swaziland when we're replicating it in Lesotho and Swaziland. Nobody's talking about Swaziland here. Tiny little country, but it's got the worst epidemic in the world. Prevalence rates close to 30%. And we've just done some work there that we're replicating in Lesotho. And I'd like to make an observation. And that is that what HIV/AIDS is doing around in these little countries of the hyper-epidemic settings in southern Africa is creating a humanitarian crisis. What we did is we went and we looked at all the indicators, economic, development, humanitarian, and health. And what we found is that on every indicator, there is a crisis emerging in these countries. When we looked at the basic indicator of mortality, we find that Swaziland is in an emergency. And when we pointed this out around the world and to the international agencies, they all said, oh dear, and did nothing. So I would argue, Alex, and I know you're sympathetic to this argument, that in many countries around southern Africa, this epidemic is creating a humanitarian crisis. And whilst it's vital that we look at what we do post-humanitarian crisis and post-conflict, we also need to look at what HIV/AIDS is doing and has done, for example, in Zimbabwe and will continue to do in countries like Swaziland, Lesotho, and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. I'd also like to recognize Dennis Altman, and I suspect that he has a point to make about the Afrocentricity of the discussion thus far.
Thanks, Alex. I'm Dennis Altman, and I'm a member of the program committee responsible for this panel. Normally, therefore, I should sit and say nothing. But as Alex said at the beginning, we did actually lose a couple of our proposed speakers, and I really did want to urge everybody to recognize that this is an issue that goes far beyond the African epidemic. And what led me to perhaps break the rules and come to the microphone is two specific points. One, I really don't think we can talk about HIV and human security in the current world without thinking about the implications of what is happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, the huge flow of people displaced by the conflicts in those countries. Which leads me to my second point, and this is in a sense a criticism of every speaker on the platform. I find it extraordinary that nobody has mentioned needle transmission and the spread of HIV through needles, the way in which drug use patterns are changed and usually developed because of situations of conflict, and while we're all limited to what we can speak from, on behalf of the organisers, can I assure you all, it really was our hope that this panel would open up a very broad discussion, would go beyond the immediate figures and data on conflict to think much more broadly, as Mary suggested in several ways, about human security and the connections between human security and HIV across the globe.
Thank you, Dennis. Now, what I'm proposing to do, given that we have slightly less than half an hour, is I have a few questions that have been written on cards, which I will pose. I will then open the microphone, and then after we've had a few contributions from the floor, I will ask each of the panelists in turn to respond to the questions, and I think that is the best way of maximizing the time. One card is from Dr. Martin Malama, Deputy Commissioner of the Zambia Police, which is a comment, not a question, but I think it's a very important one. which is the police and HIV/AIDS are a grossly neglected subject. And in issues of human security, including issues of needle transmission, issues of all the vulnerable groups that we're concerned with, the role of the police is tremendously important. Dr. Martin is encouraging all gathered here to engage with their local police forces, and I profoundly second that. I think that the police and HIV/AIDS has been really a very much neglected, very important subject. And I'm hoping that the International AIDS Society will also take this on in future conferences. The name of the questioner is not here. Competing priorities. What is the priority of HIV/AIDS in the context of conflict zones? How does HIV compare to other important problems on the public health agenda with reference to Darfur and elsewhere? Nikki Imanguli, could you please comment on human security when it comes to stigma and discrimination towards young people, especially young sex workers, young female sex workers? Deirdre, and I'm afraid my command of Irish is not is not what it should be, but and this is to you, Mary. Although an important resolution, does the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 1820 in June point to a failure of states, non-state actors, to implement UN Security Resolution 1325? And how can we ensure that international instruments such as these are implemented and progress is reported? Abby Maher has also a question on young people. How does the fact that HIV/AIDS is concentrated among young people who make up so much of the workforce affect human security? And Anna Rambe from Sweden. A research that has been carried out points to HIV/AIDS substantially affecting political participation and thereby in the long run most probably affecting democracy in affected countries. What is the time perspective before we might expect these impacts to play out? So those are the questions on cards, but the microphones are now open, and if you have a question, I ask you to line up behind the microphones. We will only be able to take 6 questions, and I also implore you to keep the questions short. Please no long statements, and let's start at the front. If you could introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Cherniak. I'm a Canadian student, and my question, I guess, is to the whole panel, specifically Mary Robinson. You mentioned that it's the 60th anniversary of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and I also wanted to point out that it's the 10th anniversary of the International Criminal Court, with what you mentioned regarding the impunity with the in the conflict in the DRC. And I was wondering that the conflict in the DRC has the second highest number of UN peacekeepers, 17,000, and yet why haven't we seen a shift of the focus of the UN, perhaps in partnership with UNIFEM, a shift in the focus to put a spotlight on HIV and sexual gender-based violence, and why isn't the media focusing on this conflict and HIV and insecurity?
Thank you.
My name is Ndinya Chola from Nairobi, Kenya. First of all, I would like to thank the presenters. And I also thought that I should not have been saying this after Alan Whiteside has spoken, but I'll go ahead and raise it anyway. I think that the information we are receiving today is very, very useful, but there is some missing link in terms of analyzing what is happening in post-conflict areas. I'm giving an example of Kenya with respect to the beginning of the epidemic way back in 1984-85, where there were two sets of refugees, one from northern Tanzania and another one from Uganda. And in this case, I think there were two risks involved. The people who came in as refugees came with their own risk factors. And then they came and found the Kenyans who added their own risk factors, and they caused a very explosive epidemic of HIV in Kenya. This is in sharp contrast to what happens in the case of the southern Sudanese who are confined in refugee states, in refugee camps in northern Kenya, and the Somali refugees. We haven't seen anything like that. And I think this is a missing link in that we are not seeing what the refugees are bringing in to where they are going and what the hosting communities also are contributing towards this kind of conflict. And I think until this is done, we may not appreciate the magnitude of the problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I am Raj Punjabi from Harvard University in Liberia. My question is directed towards Paul. Thank you, Paul, for being brave again and presenting the data that you did for HIV transmission in conflict settings. I wonder, and this is a question again directed towards you, I wonder how careful we should be, or whether you think there should be more of a distinction made between what happens, the risk of getting HIV in some of these settings and what happens to someone after they get HIV. And I say that because in our treatment program in Liberia, which your department supports, I know you're concerned about these issues, the outcomes among people who already have the disease, and that number is significant, even in a country with small prevalence, 100,000 people are estimated to be infected. The outcomes among those people who have HIV are still quite poor, and if you compare them to countries that don't have conflict like Liberia has had, you'll find that attrition rates or default rates, mortality rates are much higher among patients who have HIV for many of the same factors that are more prevalent in conflict settings: poor infrastructure, longer distances to clinics, poorer access, and less rollout of ART service to, say, rural areas. And so I bring this up in concern that donors who may be interested in funding HIV programs in general in conflict settings would at least be clear on making the distinction between getting HIV and what happens to the people who've already got it, to make sure that we still have funding and support for people who need treatment in those countries. Thanks.
Thank you very much. A good question. I was actually going to ask Paul, does this mean that we needn't worry about HIV in conflict and refugee populations?
My name is Fiona Perry from Tear Fund. I was just wondering about whether we should be looking at incidence rather than prevalence, giving us new infections. And then just secondly, just on the whole issue of different contexts, looking at fragile states, a lot of the data that you had mentioned, Paul, was on low prevalence areas. What about high prevalence? What about risk groups? So is there any data on context? Also, post-conflict, what studies are being done at the moment? You've suggested that there is vulnerability to spread of HIV, but what studies are available? Thanks.
My name is Leslie Cerny, and I'm from Simon Fraser University. I'm concerned about the lack of analysis about the countries that contribute to major HIV funding, such as the United States with PEPFAR, are also the countries that contribute to creating conditions of vulnerability and poverty in terms of the larger political economy of HIV vulnerability. And I would like the speakers to comment on that, please.
Thank you. And the final question from the floor.
Okay, my name is David. I live in Mexico City. I'm a social worker, and I've been living with HIV for over 22 years now. I'm concerned about why doesn't Latin America is considered as a territory with conflicts. We have conflicts in Chiapas. We have migrants from Central America to Mexico, from Mexico to the U.S., and also there's a lot of conflicts in Latin America. It's a pity that Latin America, again, it's invisible for the world. It's my concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Excellent point. There was one more question that came from the floor from South Africa, which is posed to Paul Spiegel, which is, could the decrease in HIV in some countries' defense forces be attributed to employment policies, selective renewal of contract, and the promotion policies, so the discharge of those who are HIV positive? Now, let me turn it back to the panel for the last 12 minutes, and let's go in the order in which the first presentations were made. So, Mary, you can start.
Okay. Well, first of all, I was delighted to hear the two presentations of my colleagues and some very informed comments from the floor and really good questions. And I think it's a pity we don't have more time. I'm going to just take a few of the questions, the ones that I feel I have something that I can respond to on. And the first I'm going to take was the question about whether the stigma and discrimination can worsen human security, can have an actual impact, and therefore make you know, increase the HIV prevalence. I was very taken by a study done by PHR, physicians and nurses and midwives, etc., 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 for human rights in Botswana and Swaziland, because they showed attitudes of stigma and discrimination had an impact on the possibility of increasing HIV prevalence. And that was the first time. It was very evidence-based, and I do appreciate that what Paul has been outlining is very important because it is evidence-based, and he's trying to improve the quality of the evidence, the quality of the data. But I thought that this study on Swaziland and Botswana was hugely important because it was mainly directed at the stigma and discrimination suffered by women and girls. And it was just so powerful. If any of you haven't read it, read that report, and I think it will just bear out just how significant it is. The second question I wanted to answer, how can I not answer when it's an Irish questioner, you know, whether the passing of 1820 in June was as much due to the failure to implement 1325, and I think the answer to that is, you know, in my view, yes. It has been very striking. We've had repeated affirmations, if you like, of 1325 since the year 2000, and yet very few countries have implemented the plans of action that are required to ensure that importance of women as decision makers, women in peace, in conflict and post-conflict and peacekeeping, etc. And most of the countries who have implemented are in Europe. They're not in areas where it would be very helpful. That is changing, and I'm pleased to say that Ireland, my own country, is involved in early stages of working on a plan of action and may in fact be twinning with some other countries, and I think that's you know, a very innovative way of accelerating implementation of Council Resolution 1325. It's very broad, and it's a very significant resolution, and the 1820 1325, I hope I said 1820 has a narrower base, but at least it does try to address what is a failure and an increasing failure to implement. The next question was about the impact on young people and how the high prevalence, particularly in countries like sub-Saharan Africa, may affect political participation, etc. I just think that Alan Whiteside has put his finger on it very much. It affects the whole social fabric, and it really is very serious. And I'm glad that he made his point so forcefully that it can, in fact, you know, itself face us with a huge humanitarian situation. On top of all that, we have the food crisis at the moment, which is really very serious. I was in Senegal not so long ago, and there were food riots while I was there in Senegal. And you know, we know of much more vulnerable countries where this is an acute, but unfortunately probably not a short-term problem. And then we have the impact of climate change. I've just come from a conference about climate change. You know, I thought I knew how serious it was. I now know that I underestimated on all counts how serious it is. And that's something that I feel obliged to really highlight from now on. I thank the Canadian student for the reference to the 60th anniversary of the Declaration of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but also reminding us 10th year of the ICC and talking about the situation in the DRC. What your question triggered for me, in fact, was when we were in Chad, in the refugee camp, we were permitted by a small NGO which was doing trauma counselling and work with women who had been severely gang raped. And she allowed us to sit and listen to those women. And as we listened, one of us, a German former minister of justice, was so outraged at what she was hearing that her first questions were, but what about impunity? Is nobody documenting this? I mean, and the sad answer, Paul, was, we were documenting. We actually had that as part of our program. But our funding from UNHCR has been cut. Let's be honest about everything. And therefore, we're not actually engaged in that program. And I know that my colleague went back to Germany and got funding. So we do need to address the impunity. Otherwise, we will not put a value on the lives of these women and girls that horrible things are happening to. If there's impunity, then it's just not important. We don't care. So it's actually absolutely vital. And I think I'll stop there, actually, because there are a number of questions that my two colleagues are better equipped to answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wasai.
Yeah, thank you very much. I will begin from the last question on countries that contribute to HIV vulnerability. Just important note that, like I said in my presentation, that HIV occurs in a social, economic, and political context. And there are studies that have been done, for instance, in Mozambique, where additional resources, 91% of additional resources under the International Development Assistance, are not being used because IMF has what is called fiscal space for countries that are under IMF programs. What that means is they say that an economy such as that one of Mozambique must spend on social spending to this level. Therefore, you can't spend over and above that even if you have more money from the donors. So that is a situation where even though we might campaign to get more funds into HIV and AIDS and even health systems, there are certain policies in international financing institutions and some other policies maybe with other institutions like the World Bank that are not helping the response to HIV and AIDS. We also need to look at things like trade, for instance, because sustainably, we are not going to win the war on HIV and AIDS through donor funding. It is important, yes. But in the long term, you want to have a system where people have money in their pockets from their sweat. So if you have a situation, for instance, like in Africa, where in 1980, Africa had 6% of the total global trade share. By 2002, it had shrunk to only 2%. Now, experts estimate that if Africa were to get just an additional 1% of global trade share, it would bring in $70 billion per year, more times than what Africa gets in terms of aid. So we need to be looking at, for instance, what are the policies under WTO that actually help these vulnerable countries to sustainably deal with HIV/AIDS in the long term? I also want to respond to the question of political participation and when this would play out. It is already playing out. Like I mentioned in my presentation, 28,000 people who are on the voters' roll in South Africa are dying per month. And those are incidences. I mean, it's not an estimation or prevalence. So what does that mean? It means that sometimes the electoral roll, you are not sure who is on the electoral roll, and politicians can easily manipulate and say, this is how many votes that I got, including those ones of people who have already died. There is also that cost that we have already seen in terms of how, for instance, Zambia and Tanzania loses in terms of having to replace these MPs because they are using what is called the majoritarian representation system, where if a member of parliament dies, for instance, you must go back to a by-election. Now, experts have suggested that maybe we need to call for proportional representation, because they are saying that whenever members of parliament of the opposition die, when they go for the by-election, it is the ruling parties that tend to win those seats back, hence interfering with the balance of power in parliament, and therefore the checks and balances to the system, interfering with the entire governance system. And on the question of police and security personnel and HIV and AIDS, I just want to note that these are some of the lowest paid people in most vulnerable countries. For instance, in the Congo, they get between $30 to $50 per month. In Kenya, for instance, we have policemen who live in very squalid conditions. Among prison warders, for instance, the prisoners live in better conditions than the prison warders. Now, what this has in terms of the impact on their behavior and how they even plan for the future, you need to have hope to be able to plan for the future. So in terms of the socioeconomic
systems within which the police operate also are drivers and in fact put them at risk of HIV infection. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the questions, which were very well informed and quite interesting. There are some questions I actually think that Alex would be the best place to answer, including the, and you did very well, the police, HIV, military, and some of the democracy questions. I won't take them in order, but in particular for Asia and Latin America, we actually do, I wanted to concentrate here on data and not actually the programs, because that's a whole other discussion. We do have numerous programs in these countries. IOM has very strong HIV programs in Colombia and other areas. Unfortunately, at least from UNHCR's point of view, except for in some parts of Asia, we don't have as strong data because probably for a good thing, the refugees are not in camps in those areas, which I think is always better when refugees are not in camps, but then it makes it extremely difficult to actually know the refugees, who they are in urban areas, and find out. And that's one of our goals in the next year or so, is to improve our data collection and understanding of urban refugees. So that's number one. It wasn't meant to ignore those areas. Number two is we have not done as well as we should have in particular with injection drug users, sex work, and we've done very, very little with MSM, and we've already made changes. So for injecting drug users, we are working with UNODC in Pakistan, Afghanistan, in Iran, which that is a very, very important area where there are some data showing that refugees have a higher injecting drug use and HIV prevalence returning to Afghanistan. So we are working on that area. Similarly, in sex work, we are making a much more concerted effort in the refugee camps, and what we're finding is not surprisingly quite disconcerting and sad, but the stigma and discrimination has been huge, and a lot of this relates also to the surrounding populations and the laws of the governments, so we have to be careful with that. And finally, with MSM, I hope in the next year to start doing that. And I would say, though, in many of the countries we're working in, the governments themselves aren't working very well in these issues, and it's more the NGOs, and that's who we will have to link up with to try to deal with these particular areas. One of the big issues, I think, was a very interesting question because it's broader for the HIV community, is the priority of HIV versus some of the other public health agenda. And in particular, we are working, and we received a fair bit of money for the Iraqi refugees in Jordan and in Syria. There is a tremendous amount of mental health issues, a lot of secondary and tertiary care issues. HIV is presumed to be very low in those populations. We don't measure HIV in those populations because if they're found to be positive, they will be deported from the country, the countries. So it gets very, very complicated. And is that so I think the other aspect that we have been working with over the last few years is when do we really, I mean, we always need to push sexual gender-based violence in these areas unrelated to HIV, but when do we push HIV in very low prevalence areas like Iraqi refugees, or do we have to prioritize other priorities while trying to do minimal HIV compared to, obviously, refugees in Southern Africa, East Africa, where the HIV prevalence is much higher, and it's essential that we do so. Two last points. Well, three perhaps. Incidence, of course, if we could be measuring incidence, it's much, much better to measure than prevalence, but we have the same problems and probably larger problems because we don't have the laboratories and technical expertise to be doing this. And as we know, many of the laboratory assays for incidence are difficult, and we don't have the capability to do prospective studies looking at HIV infection in refugee situations. Lastly, we have looked at my colleague from Kenya, very, very salient points. About 3 years ago now, we have started doing behavioral surveillance surveys amongst surrounding communities and refugee communities. And we've done this in over seven countries now, and the results have been very interesting. We have a new a new a BSS manual that takes into account the classic Family Health International manual for BSS, but really looks at the migration or the displacement issues and the level of interaction and sexual violence in these communities. And again, it's a mixed bag of what we're seeing, but for the first time, we are able to use these data and work with the local districts of health and HIV to try to do joint programming. It's not easy, as you can imagine, but it's something that we didn't do in the past, and I think it obviously has been a big mistake. It often has to do with funding and donors who say you can only use these funds for very specific populations. Last point is this whole idea of transition and refugees and displaced persons returning home. Big problem. I mean, this is one of the gaps, and I think everyone knows this, from the donors to the UN agencies. What is UNHCR's role when refugees are returning home? Do we give 3 months of does WFP give 3 months of food and we take care of them for 3 months, and then it's the government and then all the other UN agencies? It's not working very well, and we know very clearly in Angola, in Liberia, in the far-flung areas, what happens is this transition period for the most part means no care and a lack of services. And everyone is talking about it, been talking about it for 20 years, and it's an extremely difficult situation that we need to work on, but frankly, I'm not that hopeful at this point.
Thank you, Paul. Before closing, let me just pick up on a couple of points. One is on the military, and I think there's certainly some burden shifting going on here, the military discharging people who are on short-term contracts, infantrymen, etc., who are found to be HIV positive. And so the military is to some extent maintaining its relatively low HIV prevalence at the expense of wider society. It's also true that military HIV programs tend not to address the underlying structural drivers, issues of masculinity and so on. On the other hand, it's also true that the budgetary burdens on armies in terms of health care and care for widows and orphans have been increasing very substantially, and that is actually quite a significant financial burden on many militaries. On democracies, I think democracies have proved remarkably resilient as part of the AIDS Security and Conflict Initiative, which will be launching its report at the ICASA in Dakar in a few months' time. We have been studying the impact of HIV/AIDS on local government, and that's where we find more of the impact than the impact at national level. But I should also emphasize that the HIV/AIDS epidemic has coincided with a global spread of democracy, and one of the reasons for that is a tremendous commitment to human rights, civil society, and democracy by the HIV/AIDS industry itself. I cannot think of another example in history where a pandemic of an infectious disease, moreover a sexually transmitted stigmatizing infection, has actually been accompanied by a growth in human rights awareness, a growth in civil society, a growth in the representation of the most disadvantaged people on the boards of international organizations dealing with the problem. This has never happened before, and I think it's one of the great unacknowledged or under-acknowledged successes of the global campaign on HIV and AIDS. On that point, it only remains with me to thank our panelists, Mary Robinson, Wasai Nandrukululu, and Paul Spiegel, and the organizers, Kristen Newhouse and Dennis Altman, and thank you very much for attending.